Good morning. I call this meeting of the House Education Committee to order. Today is Monday, March 9th, 2026, and the time is 8:05 a.m. Happy day after International Women's Day. Present in the room today are Representative Elam, Representative Dibert, Representative Eichheit, Representative Underwood, myself, Co-Chair Himshut. I know that Co-Chair Story is dealing with some difficult travel conditions this morning and will be here as soon as she can get here safely. And Representative Schwanke is with us as well. I'd like to remind members to please silence your cell phones. We're in the Betty Davis Committee Room 106 in the State Capitol Building in Juneau, Alaska. It is beautiful here with fresh snow. The documents for today's meeting have been distributed to members, are available on the table outside the door and on basis. And there were answers to HR 39 printed out and placed at each member's spot as well. And that's one of the bills on our agenda this morning. I'd like to thank our recording secretary, Kale Brown, and our moderator from the Juno LIO, Jude Augustine, and, of course, our super capable committee aides, Tammy Smith and Ella Lubin. Thank you for your work. On today's agenda, we have several items, including a short presentation highlighting excellence in our schools, House Joint Resolution 39 relating to H-1B visa fees, House Bill 261 related to education funding, and House Bill 374 related to the base student allocation. Slide decks and supplemental materials have been posted on BASIS, and printed copies are available on the table outside the committee room. Members have copies of all slide decks. Our first presentation this morning will focus on Teacher of the Year Pete Daly. This presentation was brought forward by Representative Dibert. I want to remind members, if you have something you want to celebrate in your home district, something that is unique, something that your district does particularly well, we want to share it in a short little snippet in any one of our meetings. So just let us know when you have something, and we will add it to the agenda. I will now invite Representative Dibert to put yourself on the record and begin your testimony, and I think that Mr. Daly is online as well. So, Rep. Dibert.
Yes, thank you through the co-chair. Good morning. I don't want to take too much time, but I am very honored and excited to introduce my friend and my colleague, Pete Daly, who teaches welding at Hutchison High School, and I'm sure he'll do a much better job introducing himself. But I do want to say last summer I did get to visit his Girls in Welding program, and they had just finished some bike racks that they were donating to the community. They're beautiful, and when I was talking to some of the girls, they were just so excited to be there. They were learning welding, and I tried to pick up the tools and tried on the hat, and it's hard. It's really tough and challenging, so I just give my kudos to Pete Daly and to all the students who are lucky enough to be in his class, because I believe there's a wait list. So,
awesome.
Pete Daly, good morning. It's 10 minutes, shout out to you. So I hear you have some slides. Welcome to Education Committee.
Good morning, Mr. Daly. If you could put your name on record and share your presentation, we're really excited to have you here. And congratulations on your honor as Teacher of the Year for Alaska.
Good morning. My name is Pete Daly. As it was mentioned, I'm the 2026 Alaska Teacher of the Year. I teach welding at Hutchison High. I've been there 16 years, and I'm on my 24th year teaching in Alaska. Are my slides up?
They are. We're ready to go, and Tammy Smith is here to advance them for you.
So I know I only have 10 minutes, so on the sake of brevity, we're going to kind of zip through them. But this class started as the result of a professional development class in 2022, and we had to do something to augment our current program, and I realized that I had just a dearth of girls in any given class. I have 100 students, but there'd typically be a couple, three, four in any given class. So I decided to do a targeted focus to do more recruitment to get girls into the year-long program. And so the brainchild for this class was born that way. And so I originally started it with 12 girls. It's now branched into 16. I've done it four summers. It oscillates between Fairbanks and North Pole High, just so I can try and get as many students throughout the district as possible. If you go to slide two, that's the inaugural year. That's the original group. Slide three, I did some professional development training through the American Welding Society. There was a lady, Samantha Ferrugia, in the Detroit section. She launched a Women Who Weld class, and so I took some training through the Welding Society from her, getting ideas on how to cater it and get it more focused for girls. I put slide four as a general outline of syllabus I put together for the class. Slide five, we started doing some gas metal arc welding, and the reason I chose this process first is it's relatively user-friendly. It's easy to learn. The learning curve isn't quite as steep. So to build some confidence, we started with wire. The next slide, on slide six, we did some plasma cutting. So it's, again, a relatively simple process to learn. So that was the first week. That built some confidence, got some skills. Slide seven, we started with shielded metal arc welding, also known as stick welding. And so we got to practice that for the week. Slide eight was oxy-fuel cutting or torch cutting. So those two are a little more challenging to learn. Slide nine, we every day or most days, at least a couple, 3 days during the week, I would bring in former girls who I had in class who were in some different skilled trades. So I had students from the IBEW, the operators, students working at Fort Knox. I had Alaska Works Partnership come and talk. A variety of people came and talked. And so there's a 23, 25-year-old young lady who's talking to students relatively close to their age instead of, you know, 47-year-old Pete talking to them. So that had a little more gravitas, a little more relevancy. So that was kind of the, I guess, the beauty of this program is this. The girls started to envision themselves in those roles. On slide 10, we did a collaborative project for the community, and I do this every year. The first year, we built some bike racks. Slide 11 shows the girls welding those, fabricating them. So these went out throughout the borough. They got placed throughout the community of Fairbanks. I think one went to the Dipper, one went to Mary Sy. I think a couple went to some parks. So the last couple, the 2 years after that, we built some flower planters. Those went to North Pole Library and North Pole High School. And then last year, we built some staple-style bike racks with the Golden Heart of Fairbanks cut out in them. And then we placed those throughout the community of Fairbanks. So if you've driven around Fairbanks, you've seen them downtown. A couple went out to Esther and Goldstream. This year, we're going to do a similar project for the city of North Pole. We're going to do similar staple-style bike racks, but we're going to paint them kind of looking like candy canes, so keeping with the North Pole theme. Let's see. So slide 12 shows just using the plasma table, cutting out the bike that was welded onto each rack. Slide 13 shows the finished product. That's all the girls standing next to one of four bike racks that were made that year. We did slide 14. We went to a barbecue open house at Air Gas. There was some distributors from around the country showing their wares. Girls got to try some new equipment. A few of them bought some PPE and welding hoods. I do a field trip every year. The first year we went to Universal Welding in North Pole to a fabrication shop. The last couple of years we went out to Fort Knox Gold Mine. We go through the pit. Work to see the geotechs, they go through the ball mill, they get to see the production where the gold's crushed and refined. So pretty neat process for them. Slide 16 shows an example of a welder certification. So the students follow a welding procedure. We cut it up, we do a guided bend test, face and root, and if they pass it, meet the code criteria, they get a welder certification. That young lady in the center picture there, that's actually Eva Miskovich. She's the girl who nominated me for my state award, unbeknownst to me, found out after the fact. But, yeah, that was pretty remarkable. She's now, that was her picture there, she was in ninth grade. She has now since graduated last year, and she's in the Plumbers and Pipe Fitters. She's a first-year apprentice making $30 an hour. And within 5 years, she'll be in the high 60s. So, anyway, pretty remarkable story. So that was kind of the power of this class. I mean, she had a little fear and trepidation. It bolstered her confidence, and she took three more years plus a semester pipe fitting class with the pipe fitters to get into the apprenticeship. So pretty remarkable. And slide 17 shows we made the news minor. That's kind of neat. The girl, I bought 20-some copies, gave a copy to each girl so they had a souvenir. Slide 18 shows some survey results. I polled all the girls. I asked them if they'd recommend it to other girls. It was unanimous. And then two-thirds of them decided that they would take future classes. And that's true of the four iterations I've done so far. Most of them, either with me or with the instructor of North Pole, have went on to take more welding classes. Slide 19 just shows a certificate of completion. The girls also get some elective credit that goes on their transcript. And then slide 20, in addition to all the welding I talked about, they had time for some individual projects. So Barbie the welder has a project book, and they made some silverware creations, some little animal figurines. So that was kind of fun, just to add a little levity to the class. So I don't want to run out of time. Slide 21, there's a video. Whoever's running the slides, if you play that, and then stop it at 2 minutes and 10 seconds, and then we should have a minute or two for some questions.
Okay, we're loading that up right now.
Yeah, my name is Pete Daly. And I've been teaching for 20 years. I teach at Hutchinson High School. I've been here for 12 years and then taught 8 years in some rural districts throughout Alaska. Women make up only 4% of the welding industry, so I thought, well, I could do something about that. And so it was kind of multi-pronged, kind of served the needs of the class, but I also wanted to expand my population and grow my program. So I'm hoping that this will end up helping with getting more fed into the program.
My name is Erica Lopez. I am 17 years old. I am graduating 2023, and I go to Hutchinson High. I'm a senior. I'm almost done with everything, and then this program came up, and I was like, you know what, might as well give it a chance, and I did, and I learned more than I would have been here.
My name is Gracie Davis, and I'm originally from Bethel, Alaska. I lived there for 11 years, and I moved to Fairbanks my senior year. I graduated just this last May, and I'm going to school for process tech, and I'm hoping to go and work in Prudhoe Bay.
Being all female, it where some of them may have been fearful or had a little trepidation, they've kind of stepped out, and I'm seeing some leaders that maybe wouldn't be so bold if it was a mixed class, so I can see some future leaders running some crews here in not too distant futures.
I just have a lot of respect for Mr. Daly, and like having him actually ask me to help him and wanna like teach with me, it's just the coolest thing. With this Women's for the Trades class, I can constantly see everybody's picking each other up. Someone needs help, we're here, you know, there's always someone to help.
Okay, Mr. Daly, did you want to add anything to that video? It was pretty pretty self-explanatory. any final comments?
I guess I will say this. So when I talked to the commissioner about my state award, I asked her why me, and she said, well, out of 100 people who were nominated, 44 of you actually picked up the ball and ran with it. But she said the three things that stood out were your innovative programs, i.e. the Pipe Academy and the girls' class that you just saw there. The other two were my community partnerships. I run a welding advisory committee, a lot of business and industry partners, plumbers and pipe fitters, Fort Knox, a lot of different fab shops. And then the third was my mentorship that I do, not just with students, but with other instructors. I helped the North Pole instructor study for his CWI. So, yeah, that girls' class, though, single-handedly vaulted me into several other awards that I've recently received. So. Anyway, I'm going to open it up for any questions.
Okay, great. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Eichheit?
Thank you, Chair. Co-chair.
Eichheit, before you ask your question, I wanted to recognize that Co-Chair Story joined us at 8:12, and we've also been joined by Representative Galvin, who has a presentation later, and Representative Ruffridge has joined us this morning. Okay, Representative Eichheit.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Hemshoot. Through the co-chair, just Mr. Daly, comment, not a question. I'm a former teacher myself. I love this presentation. I think the best thing we can do for kids in Alaska and around the world, for that fact, is to put a highly qualified long-term teacher in front of them. You know, there's that saying, you can't teach old dogs new tricks. Well, sir, you've been teaching for a while, and this is a recent program, and you're teaching new tricks to the future, and I really appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Eichheit. Representative Elam.
Thank you. I really appreciate the presentation, and congratulations on the awards. The CTE programs have always been something that's been near and dear to me, so I appreciate the effort and the work that you've put into it. So I guess I will ask a question. What were some of the challenges you ran into with trying to get this kind of a program started up and currently run into from day to day?
Mr. Daly?
Yeah, of course, through the chair, just getting the funding and getting the partnerships, just the logistics of setting everything up. Of course, anytime you run something that's new, there's novelty, but there's also some hurdles that you have to surmount. But it's pretty streamlined now. Other people are coming to me and wanting some of the action, and so I've recently partnered with Fairbanks Fast Planning, and so they were the last group to help with funding for the bike racks, and they're going to do the similar funding for the ones in North Pole this summer.
So some creativity there.
And if one just brief follow-up, just curious what kind of general engagement you're finding, or if there's been any kind of, you know, improvements for the girls there that are in your program.
Mr. Daly?
Yeah, so there's actually a lot of interest, and I unfortunately have to turn girls away because, you know, there's only 16 spots. The shop has limited space. And so there's definitely the demand. And a lot of the girls do transition into something at least tangentially related to welding. Some of them have gone into process technology. The one girl who was kind of giving testimony, she was saying she was going to go up north. She actually works directly for Hilcorp now, and she's making $50 an hour. I mean, she's like 20 years old. So a couple of the others are working at some auto dealerships. Some of them are in some skilled trade unions. Some are in school for engineering. But others, you know, there's one girl who works for her family business in a carpet store. The other girl is going to school at UAA for dentistry. So, I mean, it just depends. But most of them do get involved some way in industry.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we need to wrap up shortly, but Representative Underwood.
Thank you, through the chair. I just wanted to quickly say, I don't know if this was pre-planned, that yesterday was International Women's Day, so it was really nice to see all those women in welding and doing trades. In the Mat-Su, I know we have a welding program, and I went and visited this last summer, and it was majority of girls as well. They were very attracted to the welding program, and it was just really, really awesome to see. So seeing this happen in other parts of the state and what you're doing, it makes my heart sing. So I just wanted to say thank you, and hopefully we can get this spread all over Alaska.
We do have a lot to celebrate in our schools. Representative Dibert.
Most of my questions were answered or asked already, but I'll just say thank you so much. I'm not sure if you're in school yet, if you're getting ready to teach your class, but I just want to thank you for giving your time, Mr. Daly. And I was reminded that the girls' single projects, where they were creating their own welding individual projects, that was amazing last summer. And just seeing them help each other problem solve with their items they were making and who they were making them for. I think I met one of them who said it was a special project for her dad, and she couldn't wait to give it to him. So what you're doing is amazing. Keep it up, and we'll see you soon.
That's great. And just to wrap up, Mr. Daly, I wanted to ask you if you wanted to add anything, or you may not have anything to add. About 100 teachers were nominated, 44 completed the process. So I guess if I have a question, my question is, I never applied. Doubt that I was ever nominated. I don't think I ever was. But I will say I helped somebody else with their application, and I think you learn as much from applying for Teacher of the Year as you gain from the recognition if you are the one selected. Like, it's a pretty rigorous application process and a really good opportunity to kind of reflect on your teaching. Can you say just a little bit about what that process looks like, and maybe we can get more than 44 to apply next time?
Yeah, so they have to be nominated. They don't apply. And so I was kind of miffed that, you know, 100 people were nominated, and, like, why wouldn't you go through the process? Maybe they thought it was too laborious. I don't know. And, it was pretty involving. You had to write some essays. You had to get 5 letters of recommendation. I had to film a 5-minute direct instructional video. I had to submit lesson plans. I mean, I had standards and rubrics. Yeah, it was pretty extensive. I had to do a 15-minute slide deck presentation. I learned how to use Screencastify. I had to narrate it as I went through the slides explaining about the process. So the national teacher application was just as extensive. Again, more submissions, reflection. So you're right. It is a good time for introspection and for reflection and to hone your craft.
Well, thank you so much for giving us part of your morning, and I need to look into it, but I think Alaska has had, in the last 5 or 6 years, we've had 2 or 3 years where our Teacher of the Year was in the top 4 finalist pool for the National Teacher of the Year. I don't know if you know any stats on that. Otherwise, we're just going to move on. I'm going to get that information for the committee somewhere else. Mr. Daly, do you know?
Cat Walker was the last one from Anchorage in 24, yep.
Yep, and then I think Danielle Reha also was in the top 4 pool at one point. So I'll look into that a little bit and bring that information back to the committee, because it's pretty impressive that our small state would have so many teachers make that top 4 finalist pool at the national level. So anyway, Mr. Daly, thank you so much for your time this morning. We went a little long. I think it was 100% worth it, but we're going to move on to our next thing. So our next agenda item is House Joint Resolution 39 by Representative Galvin, entitled Urging the Federal Government to Waive the New H-1B Visa Fees for Teachers in the State. An amendment deadline was set during the previous hearing of this resolution, and no amendments were received. The committee previously heard public testimony on this resolution. Representative Galvin and staff, would you like to come forward and introduce yourselves for the record, and we'll see if there are questions for you.
Good morning, Co-Chair Himshute. My name's Elise Galvin. I represent District 14.
Good morning. For the record, Dan Hires, legislative intern to Representative Galvin.
Good morning. Thanks for being here. Does the committee have questions on this resolution? And is there anything you wanted to add, Representative Galvin?
I don't wish to add anything. I hope that you received what Dan Hires sent to you. He answered all of the questions, I believe, that you presented in the last meeting. I want to make sure that you have that. And just thank you for giving us the time to consider this resolution.
Thank you for, and just for members, this is on, I think it's also on BASIS, and it's this document at your seat. So, okay, seeing no questions on the bill, I'm going to entertain a motion. Representative Story?
Thank you, Co-Chair Himshute. I move House Joint Resolution 3934-LS1535/A with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, House Joint Resolution 3934-LS1535/A moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note, and we're going to take a quick at ease to do the paperwork. Thank you so much, Representative Galvin, for being here, and Mr. Hires.
Thank you.
We are back on record, and we're going to go to our next order of business. We had Co-Chair Story move out there to the testifying table. We're going to take up House Bill 261, sponsored by Representative Story, entitled An Act Relating to Education Funding and Providing for an Effective Date. So Co-Chair Story and Tammy Smith, if you guys want to put yourselves on record and begin the, I guess, begin the discussion.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Hemshude. For the record, Andy Story representing District 3, which is the North Mendenhall Valley here, out the road, Haynes, Skagway, Cluckmont, and Gustavus.
And I'm Tammy Smith, staff for Representative Story.
So thank you for the opportunity. I wanted to come before the committee today to update you a little bit on the discussions I've been having on House Bill 261. First of all, I want to remind you what that bill is about. This bill is about a recommendation that was made actually in 2015 from Augenblick, Palish, and Associates, who were examining our foundation formula, had, as part of that process, talked to many of our teachers, superintendents, about our foundation formula, and what some recommendations were made. And in November of this last year, I'm sitting on the Education Task Force for Education Funding, and we had reviewed that presentation, and actually one of the authors of that presentation, Justin Silverstein?
Yes.
Silverstein.
Thank you. Sorry, Justin, if you're listening. Justin Silverstein had done a presentation on student counts. And why this is, I think, something Alaska should really seriously consider. Not only was it recommended, and many other states are doing it, but it is to help give our districts certainty, give them some more certainty for their fiscal planning for the year. It helps families and communities. And it also helps with keeping our teachers for retention. And what I mean certainty is what would happen with this bill is the districts will have a choice rather than to take the previous three-year average or the previous year student count. Remember, districts are funded by student count, how many students they have, and whether there is an increase in the base student allocation or not. So by changing something with the student count, if on July 1st of their current fiscal year, if they knew their number, they can go ahead and plan with more certainty. And again, in March, they can give out teacher contracts for those teachers, longtime beloved teachers that they know they want to keep, and of course, as much as their budget allows, keeping those newer teachers. So we'll always have, this is not the silver bullet solution. We will always have to look at, are we keeping up with costs for school districts, which is with the base student allocation formula. But it can help provide certainty, which is really important in any kind of occupation. And this is, of course, our children and their education. So I wanted to say a couple. I've actually got like 9 points to make. But I first wanted to remind you of the definition for the three-year averaging of the student count. And for this bill, the three-year average is the 3 years previously where the student count is known by July 1st. And that, so I'm just going to use an example. If we were passing this bill starting July 1st of 2026, the 3 years of the student count are from 2022, 2023, and 2024, October of those student count dates. And so then there's also a definition of the previous year, and the previous year is the student count 2025 that they just finished in October. And I've had to explain that a lot. And the reason why it's 22, 23, and 24 is because those are the student count periods that are known. Right now, they're just finishing up 2025 because it takes a long time to validate. Some districts, sometimes there's two students declared in two districts, as an example, and it takes a while just to say, where really is that student? So there's, and that's just one small example. But so that's why it's 22, 23, 24, because those times are known, so districts can pick that. And then because it's July 1st, we're going to know pretty soon, March, April, what the 2025 number was. So then districts could pick either the previous year 2025 or that three-year averaging. Any questions about that?
Representative Elam?
Thank you. You know, as I've kind of contemplated HB 261, I guess my questions or concerns kind of come around when in times of growth, right? So what would this do to districts during a time of growth? And does it have impacts on specific schools during times of growth? So say you were doing in the MATSU, for example, they've been growing at a pretty good climb. We've started doing some climbing over in the Kenai as well. And I know certain pockets of Anchorage have actually been having some significant climbs. Would they not benefit from the climb for 3 years as well? And then what about with, say, other small schools like, say, a charter school, for example, if they expanded and then they brought in 30 or 40 students, which would increase the student population in that school, would the benefits be noticed or would they be delayed?
Representative Story.
Yes, through the chair. Yeah, thank you for that question. And that is one of the points that I'm going to make that people have been bringing up to me in comments, because what I'm so I was just wondering if we had questions about the student count that I'd explained. So that's okay that you jumped ahead there. But why I'm having this conversation today is I'm hoping what I can do is from this conversation and your thoughts that I can draft a committee substitute for us to be working from and bring that back to the committee. And when you adopt a committee substitute, we're just sort of, there's kind of many levers. And then when that committee substitute comes back to us, then we can make amendments from that as we go forward too. So it's, I'm just trying to summarize everything I've been hearing. And so one of those points is the recommendation from districts that if there is a certain percentage increase in the student count that they see in the fall, because again, they will have their count from last year, if they pick the most previous, because it's on an uptick, so they probably wouldn't pick the three-year averaging, they would pick the last year. Then if the certain percentage uptick, then they would be able to count those students. The department could fund them from those students. And I did talk to Rep. Hemshoot, and I had a conversation with Commissioner Bishop this last week, and that was one of her suggestions, was to have a set a certain percentage.
Okay, thank you.
And then you're right, though, the three-year averaging, it would catch up eventually if we did nothing. They would know that then next year they're going to have a higher number. But again, you want to hire your staff. You're going to be hiring your staff to serve those students. So that's why if you're on an uptick, there needs to be an adjustment for that.
And so, Co-Chair Story, just to make sure I'm understanding, we would be, the decision would rest with the district. If you're a district that has had some growth, you might go with last year's count because that's going to reflect mostly what you'll need for your coming year's staff. But if you're in a district that is stable or declining, you would go with that three-year average because that's going to best predict the staffing that you'll need.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hemshoot. Yes.
Okay.
But again, and then again, what Rep. Elam was talking about was if they noticed, oh, boy, I've got, 30 extra kids, just this fall. If it's over a certain percentage, then DEED would have the direction to move forward and fund those students.
Okay, that seems super beneficial.
So along those lines, that was one suggestion to put into the CS. The other suggestion was, what about if you're starting a brand new school? Or a brand new charter school. The charter school, that is in our statute already, how to address that, since we do have started charter schools. But so there'll be language in there for what happens when you get a new school. How will their averaging work? Probably just be their last year, previous student count, and they'll grow into it. But there needs to be language for that. The other thing I wanted to really talk about was I'm aware of the fiscal climate that we are in. And in this bill is an adjustment that does need to be made for alternative schools. Remember, they are smaller schools, but they're put in with the largest school in their district. And I believe in the bill, and Tammy might have to correct me on this, I can't remember if it's $5.8 million that costs or $4.8 million. And we'll let her look that up. But, oh, 5.8. Okay, $5.8 million. We asked, I wanted to thank Lori Weed for meeting with me to, we have a big fiscal note number, and I'd asked her to break it down for us. And so, anyway, that was one of the components, the alternative schools. And so what I'm going to recommend in the committee substitute is to take that out. It is a need. And someone might in the committee substitute might recommend in committee to put that back in when I bring it before you again. But it might need to be a separate bill at some time to address that. The task force might want to address that in January when they make their report.
Sorry, can you explain what that section of the bill does? Even if you take it out, remind us what that section does.
Thank you. So that section of the bill, it recognizes that alternative schools serve students, vulnerable students for some reason. And right now, like I'll just use my district for an example, and I want to say there's 12 alternative schools, but I'm sorry, I'm not exactly sure on that amount. But our school, on your our high school is over 750 students, and so those students are funded not at 1.0 based on allocation, but due to the school size factor and supposedly economies of scale, they're actually funded at 0.84. So all those students get, the district gets 0.84 for them. And then the alternative school students, they, by statute, they have to be funded as the same as that, the largest school in your district. So they are funded at 0.84, when actually what this bill does is have them funded at their school size adjustment. So if they were, can't remember the exact school size adjustment for 84 students, but it is like 1.3 or it's something higher. And so... I see that Rep. Elam has a question.
Okay. Representative Elam.
Thank you. I guess, you know, another thought that I was thinking about as we were kind of, you know, going over this is if we take like a 10-year snapshot, which districts or schools would have received less funding versus more funding over that 10-year period, you know, with this formula versus maybe what we've done historically with the previous formulas?
Story.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Through the chair, I do not have that information, but I will try my best to get a snapshot, and I might pick a handful of districts, and I will try and pick Kenai's. But I would encourage all of you to ask your districts, their business officials, to run those numbers for you. I think it'd be great to have a good conversation. I think that knowledge will help you in our next discussion with the committee substitute. Get a good feel for how it would be impacting districts. So thank you for that good question.
And it might be wise to run it on the current bill before the CS to see about that alternative school. If the alternative school section is going to be taken out of the CS, it might be helpful to know what impact that would be in your district or districts. Okay, Co-Chair Story?
Yes, thank you. So I'm going to go down the list of the couple of other things I have, and then I'll ask for questions again.
Okay.
So focusing on the three-year average, that was the recommendation from the task force. I am going to, if you look at the last fiscal note, there were seven districts that were impacted by that negatively, and many of them were in hold harmless. And so the CS I'm going to propose is that it grandfathers in the districts that are currently in hold harmless. Again, this will all come before you, and amendments can be made on the CS. The next thing is the intensive student count, and this is huge. I think the number was like $47 million is what the cost for the intensive students was in the fiscal note we got before us. And then in talking with several people, including the deed and superintendents, if you take a three-year average of the student count, the intensives, you could be getting money for intensives, and remember, they're 13 times the base student allocation for students you do not have, and it ups the fiscal note significantly because we're kind of double funding them. And so the recommendation for the intensive student counts is that they would take the previous year, so in this example, it would be fiscal year 25, whatever intensive counts, student counts you had, once they were trued up, at the end of the year, that's the number you would start with. So that is going to be a change that I'm going to recommend. And then I'm going to keep in truing up the intensive counts in February 15th. because if you get an intensive student, you will be hiring a new staff person, and districts are going to need to have to meet the needs federally of the student who's intensive. And so the district would be able to hire staff in the fall for that student who shows up, who's intensive, and know they're going to get payment for that in February. Having said that, there always is, DEED has to look at the districts certifying that student as intensive and make sure there's agreement upon that. There have been denials, and then the district gets to do their appeal, and so there is always some further explanation. And sometimes that's just what is needed is further explanation because it's hard to understand a student on a piece of paper. So I'm going to keep the Cliff Points the same. That means the 100
small schools factor.
No, schools. It has to do with your facilities. I'm trying to think of what it says in statute. Facilities constituting a school. Yeah. That's what it is. Thank you. Sorry about that. I should be able to cite the statute. I've looked at it, but I can't. Facilities constituting a school. So what's unique about our formula is when you get to be a 100-size student school, you can, over that, 101, 130, you can choose to become two schools and have your K through 6 and your 6 through 12. And so those Cliff Points are if you're at a school that's like you're 103 students and then you drop to 99, if by averaging it, you can keep your two-school formula. And so 100 and 425 are the Cliff Points. And so that's going to stay in there. That was also a recommendation for Augenblick, Palish, and Associates. So I wanted to keep those core components in there. I talked about if there was a significant population increase. I talked about a new school. The one thing I did. Yes, and I talked about hold harmless, grandfathering those in. And then I did want to talk about one thing that I did that totally just not realizing it. I had said the student count would be done based on the student count October 15th. Well, I didn't mean to change the student count at all. I don't know why I directed Ledge Legal to put the 15th in there, but I'm just keeping that the same, how we calculated student count 20 days ending in October. So that you will see that change, but that was just an error on my part at the beginning, and I've had to explain that several times to people. So those are just a second. I'm going to just confer with Tammy to see. Okay, thank you. Tammy wanted me to correct on the record. It was $43 million for the extra intensives, not 47, as I had first said. And there is still going to be a significant number for intensive students. The department says they cannot estimate how many they would add in the true-up. That's not reflected in the fiscal note. But I have asked Dr. Lisa Parody of the Alaska Council of School Administrators to do a survey of the one question survey of the districts to see how many students do you think we're talking about? Maybe most districts don't get a new intensive, but you know how many do, so I can kind of compute that ourselves for the committee.
And I would just point out, and correct me if I'm wrong, but these costs are happening right now in districts, and it would shift that expense from the district back to the state. So if an intensive needs student moves into your district in January from another Alaska district, the staff you hired to work with that student in August when school started still has to be paid. There's a contract. And then if the student's family moves to a new district, the district has to figure out how to hire staff for that person. And so the districts bear these costs, and you're just shifting the cost back to the state for that added expense.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hemshut. Yes, that is true. I think the main thing about that is if an intensive starts with the school district, an intensive student, the district has to hire someone for that student. And then when they move to another district, the district has to hire someone for that student. It is not realistic to have that teacher who has a contract in Kenai to all of a sudden go to Juneau. And we do know with our special education population that we have having more students who who have needed supports under special education, and I have no doubt that the district will be using that that position wisely with the current student special education students they have. So I wasn't my intent at all to remove that. In fact, I don't know how I could do it because there is a contract with that individual who came on to work with that student for the year.
And so, it would be unusual to be overstaffed in special education.
Yes, like thank you. That was much
that person will always be put to good use.
Thank you, Co-Chair Himshute. So those are what I have on my list. I think I made it through it all. I'm sure in the CS, if there's something that I missed, it will be there, and I will. But I wanted to bring that forward right now, too, to have a little discussion to see if there's anything else you had been thinking of at this moment that I should consider in the CS. But I know that was a lot to think about. And so the beauty of the CS is it comes back before us, and then that's our working document, and we can make further amendments as the committee sees fit.
Okay. Any last questions for Co-Chair Story? Ms. Smith. Okay. Thank you so much, Ms. Smith and Co-Chair Story, for your presentation. We're going to take a quick at ease to transition to the next bill. So we'll go at ease.
We are back on the record,
And our next order of business is House Bill 374, sponsored by the House Education Committee, entitled An Act Relating to the Base Student Allocation and Providing for an Effective Date. I am pleased to see that Co-Chair Hemshute and Staff Ella Lubin is at our dais. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Good morning. I'm Rebecca Hemshute. I represent House District 2, 21 coastal communities between Heidelberg and Yakutat. And with me is my staff.
Hello. For the record, my name is Ella Lubin, staff to Representative Hemshute.
Thank you to the committee and Co-Chair Story for hearing this bill today. We're excited about this bill. So I want to remind the committee that Article 7 of Alaska's Constitution says the legislature shall, not may, not might, not could, shall establish and maintain a system of public schools open to all children. So with that constitutional mandate in mind, we are bringing forth a bill to increase the BSA. As a reminder, this animation is like fading in, fading out. Okay. To fund the BSA requires two steps. First, we have to increase it in statute, and then we have to fund it in the operating budget. So those two steps are required to change the foundation formula for the schools and the base student allocation, which is the number upon which all other factors are calculated. So prior to last year, our districts had experienced a pretty much flat funding in the base student allocation. There was a $30 bump with the READS Act, but otherwise we had flat funded the base student allocation for about a decade. Last year we did pass House Bill 57 and had a number of policy measures in it. It also included a $700 BSA increase. We know that if we had adjusted the BSA to make districts whole to the purchasing power that they had had at their peak in 2011, we would have needed $1,800. We were able to pass a $700 increase. That was approximately $20 more than districts had received in one-time funding. The difference between the one-time funding and the BSA, I'm sure members are aware, that one-time funding, you don't know. You don't know as a district when you'll get it, if you'll get it, and how much you'll get. With the BSA, we have made a promise to our districts, a commitment to our districts, that they will have this money going forward so they can already make plans for the next school year. If we pass House Bill 261, they'll be even more concrete in their planning. But in the absence of that, at least they know what to expect from the state. And, of course, an increase is needed, but they know that it's not one time. They know that when it's inside the BSA, this is a promise from us to our school districts based on our constitutional obligation.
Excuse me, Rep. Hemshute. I was just going to note that I appreciated you bringing up that it was $20 more than the one-time funding the year before. Districts had received $680. Per student in one-time funding. And so because why this is important to remember, as many people have said to me, boy, it was increased $700 per student, and the districts are just still in having these huge cuts. And I've had to remind people that the prior year, it was one-time funding of $680, so it was a $20 increase. And that is why it was good, because it was permanent, and they don't have to predict even more uncertainty. But thank you for indulging me that comment.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I hope this is more of a back and forth than a one-way presentation. So please, at any moment. So inflation and fixed costs, I'm going to let you do that, have outpaced funding. So we put some examples in here. We're still collecting data from districts across the state, but we know some facts. Since 2020, property insurance in Anchorage has risen by 42%. Liability insurance in Anchorage has risen by 139%. Health benefits in Cuspuck have risen by 33%. We put Sitka's energy increases in here. We recognize this is a bit of an outlier, but 45% is still a number that they're having to deal with in Sitka. And then we'll be talking in the Education Funding Task Force this afternoon about maintenance, but we have aging facilities. We built a lot of our schools in the 80s, in the 90s. Those buildings are 40, 50 years old now. And as a result, it just takes more money to maintain an older facility. And then just to remind everyone, the CPI is urban Alaska, and it's gone up 20%. So a lot of these costs have outpaced even basic inflation.
Excuse me, Co-Chair Hemshut. Rep. Dibert has a question.
Thank you to the co-chair, to Representative Hemshut. Do you have the inflation for all the districts somewhere or in your work? Thank you for doing this work.
Sure. Thank you. Through the co-chair, we are sampling 10 districts, the big five urban districts, and then we selected a rural or remote district in each of the judicial districts, and then we threw in an extra one to make it an even 10. We're still collecting that information back. We did hear back from Anchorage and Cuspuck, and then we interviewed Sitka separately. So we are collecting more information, and we'll be happy to share it with the committee when we have it. Okay, everyone has it. Okay. So posted on BASIS and also through the co-chair at your seats is a survey from ACSA, the School Administrators Organization, and that survey, I think you'll see it has a lot of blue type on it. That does have, I can't remember what else in there, it was the gap that they're predicting between what they have now and what they need. So it doesn't have all of the questions that we're surveying in 10 districts, but it's covers more of the districts. And it's their projected deficit. Okay. So some of the things that we've added to districts in the time period or expectations that we have include the READS Act, which we're finding, we think preliminarily, is having some really good results in our districts, really helping to make sure that everybody can read by third grade. That's really, really important for future success. That has come with extra, I hate to use the word burdens because I know districts are happy to do it, but it comes with extra expenses for districts. So they have to pick up the reading intervention plans, early literacy instruction, some tutoring that's required. And then it's not even just, you know, somebody once said, we're just asking them to teach reading a different way. There's more to it in the READS Act. We are asking districts to provide summer tutoring. We are asking districts to write reading intervention plans for students who are not making the benchmarks. So there's more to it, and that comes at either an outright cost of having to hire a reading interventionist or purchase new curriculum, and the state has been great at helping, but it hasn't been universal and it hasn't been every district. So for every district implementing this, there have been either actual costs or you could talk about opportunity costs. Some of you heard, maybe all of you, I think all of you heard from the principal at Ray C. Stedman Elementary School in Petersburg, very proud of that school district. The principal in the elementary school there has written, applied for, received grants. Every time a principal is writing a grant application or administering a grant that was received, that principal is not with teachers and not with students. And a grant is a finite period of time. So it can have great impact, and I know that districts are willing to do whatever it takes, but there is an opportunity cost. Every time a principal is redirected to seeking funding, that is time that is not spent on the educational program at the school. Wanted to talk a little bit about career and technical education. We're seeing amazing things happening across all of our districts. Unfortunately, not all of our districts, because some of the smaller districts have a really hard time getting this off the ground. But those materials are more expensive. If you buy curriculum for an academic content area, you can use that curriculum for years. If you buy I'm out of my depth here, but sheet metal. You're going to use that with your students, and then it's consumable. You're going to have to replace that. So that comes with some higher costs. And then I think it's just important to note that industry professionals are expensive, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that expense. Cuspuck District was able to share with us their expenses that they calculated for the READS Act. So before the READS Act and after the READS Act, they were spending an amount more, and that's the $403,000 that you see. And they broke that down into their MTSS plan training, money spent on data coordination, reading intervention training, parent communication, after-school tutoring, intervention materials, et cetera, et cetera. Some of this they had state help. A lot of this fell just to the funding that they were getting through the BSA. So those costs are there, but the results are also there, and that's the ideal. We did have a special order last week on you reap what you sow, and if you don't fund your schools, you may not get the outcomes you're looking for. So I'm stating the obvious, I think. Okay, on teacher recruitment retention, Anchorage was able to quantify for us that about 88% of their annual budget goes towards staff wages and benefits. Education is an inherently human endeavor. You are going to need an educator, and you're going to need assistance for that educator to really work with the students. And so it's a people-driven, I hate to say industry when we talk about schools, but I'll use the term, people-driven industry, and people cost money. So our wage increases are built in, so districts can't just decide not to do those increases from year to year. That's a fixed cost that will always go up. And then if they negotiate to keep their educators, that's another cost that's only going to go in one direction. And we have a turnover rate of 28% in Alaska. I always like to point out, we know what it costs to replace a teacher. It used to be $20,000. That's creeping up towards $30,000 per teacher. But what's more difficult to quantify is the loss in student learning. And so I think it's really, really important to bear that in mind. I did find a study that talks about that, that does try to measure that. And it's not small. So it's also important to know that the national teacher turnover rate is around 8%. So Alaska's teacher turnover rate is vastly higher. Some of this is solved with more money. Some of this is solved with better benefits. And there's a lot we can do in both arenas to improve our turnover rate. And we see districts tackling that problem. We see the apprenticeship programs. We see Educators Rising. We see things happening in our districts to address the problem, but there's only so much they can do with the current BSA that they're getting in the face of the other fixed costs that they have. And again, I'm going to just state the obvious. It's more cost-effective to implement retention strategies than it is to continuously recruit and train new educators. And again, that cost is measured not just in dollars. That cost is measured in student learning.
Rep. Hemshut, I wanted to comment that I know as legislators, we have our different bargaining units, state employees who work for the state of Alaska, and we oftentimes we have our negotiators, and then the agreements come to us, and we fund those. And so we do have increases in our state budget for our state employees, and recognizing costs of living and the importance of staff being able to afford to live in the great state of Alaska. And I know that happens in every other state, how they fund their staff. I think what's important to remember is that school districts cannot tax. They cannot. They do not have any revenue. So when they are giving increases to their staff, which they need to, it comes out of what could go into the classroom. And I often felt that was really hard as a school board member myself when I wanted to lower class sizes, yet I knew when I was giving raises to teachers, because staff was 85 to 90% of our budget, that we would probably have to do something that parents do not want 100% is to raise PTR. So it was always really hard, and we were always hoping for our funders, being this legislature, that they would recognize that. So I appreciate this slide and you bringing that forward.
Thank you, Coach Story. I'll point out I served on the bargaining team a couple of times over my, we'll say, long career as a teacher. And I was very uncomfortable in that space because I knew that any increase to me could result in a decrease to programs for students because there was only so much money. And so it was an uncomfortable endeavor to negotiate. But I also knew if inflation was going up by 2% and I wasn't receiving more than 2% growth in my wages, then I would be falling behind. And so I appreciate, it's a longer philosophical discussion, but the legislature basically entrusts the job of educating students to local school districts with locally elected boards, because what education looks like in Fort Yukon is going to be very different from what it looks like in Sitka or Anchorage. And so we would be probably the worst people on the planet to actually run schools as legislators. Mm-hmm. However, our locally elected school boards with the professional educators, superintendents, principals, school leaders, they are well situated to meet the needs of our students and to continuously work on better outcomes. So, okay, I'm calling this one the elephant in the room. Enrollment has to be discussed. I want to point out at the bottom of the table the minus 3%. This is dropping enrollment statewide. To me, what this indicates is families are making the choice to leave Alaska. So this it doesn't matter which form of public school you're in, we have lost enrollment to people leaving our state. Young families saying, the quality of life that I love in Alaska does not balance out with the loss of opportunities for my child or children. And then on the right, we point out the even larger drops in enrollment that some districts are experiencing, increase in enrollment in MATSU. The reason I think it's important to talk about the drop in enrollment is we fund based on how many students you have. So if you built a building for 200 students and you now have 100 students in that building, you will have less funding to heat that building, less funding to run the bus route, less funding for the absolutely mandatory insurance costs that you'll have for the facilities and for the employees you have in that building. So those expenses don't go down even when enrollment goes down. And I know that the Education Funding Task Force is taking a deeper dive on this. I also know that districts are not in a good position to wait an additional year for those recommendations to lead to bills that will lead to change. So in the meantime, the tool we have is the base student allocation, and that's why we're here with this bill today. I did want to point out that I've heard from families, born and raised Alaskans, who are saying, we just can't stay. It's too unstable in our schools, and what our children will have in school is not what we had in school. We're going to have to go somewhere else. And that, I guess I would say that keeps me up at night. So, okay. Here's how we calculated our request of the legislature this year through the BSA bill. We took the big five school districts, and again, we're still collecting data from other districts, and I'm going to be completely forthright with how we did this calculation. For each of these five districts to continue their program as it is next year, to offer next year's students what they're offering this year's students, whether that's librarians and nurses or a building heated to 72 degrees instead of 65 degrees, which there's a statute about that. They don't have a choice. To meet those expenses and still offer the same program, Anchorage has a gap of $90 million. And if you run down the list, you see all the gaps that the districts have. You'll notice Fairbanks is an outlier. Fairbanks is in the black this year. I want to talk about why Fairbanks is in the black. Fairbanks is in the black because they've cut over 300 staff since 2019. They've closed 7 schools in 5 years. And they have class sizes up to 40 in the high school and 26 in the elementary school. This is not the education that we want to provide students in Alaska. So having made those incredibly difficult, you can call it right-sizing. I think for the families attending those closed schools, it doesn't feel like right-sizing. It feels like a loss of opportunity. So with that in mind, Fairbanks is in the black. But we took the 5 largest districts, we asked them what their need was, and then we found the mean average of that need, and that's why we're here today with a $630 increase. The $630 would not make every district whole. So if you look at what it would do, for Anchorage it would meet half the need. So if you are interested in the term right-sizing, Anchorage is going to have to do some cutting, some serious cutting that Fairbanks already did. So our question is really what does it mean to have $1 million gap versus what it means to have a $45 million gap? And those decisions would have to be made locally. I'm only asking that the state hold up our side of the bargain, which is to maintain a system of schools open to all the children of the state. So with that, I welcome questions. And I wanted to add one more note. We heard from Pete Daly this morning, our current Teacher of the Year. I think everybody noticed recently 2 Teachers of the Year, our 2018 and our 2024 Teachers of the Year, born and raised Alaskans. One was born and raised in Sitka. The other, I think, was an Anchorage kid. And they are amazing educators. I know them both because they're science educators, and I had the great opportunity of teaching science as an elementary science specialist. And those folks are leaving the state with their school-age children. I just again, the things that keep me awake at night are things like that. So thank you for hearing the bill. I'm happy to take any questions.
Yes, we do have some invited testimony this morning, but does anyone have any questions at this moment? Rep. Elam.
Thank you. I guess, you know, when we have the conversation here, part of the question that I have is fundamentally what we have been uncovering over the last while is that really it appears that the foundation formula seems to have some flaws with it. The separation of facilities from academics is one. When student enrollment goes down, Representative Story, we just heard from her in 261. So I guess my question would be is, should we be addressing the formula versus the BSA right now? Because we just did identify – or we just did BSA adjustments. And so it just seems like the timing is really that we should be working on the formula.
Thank you for the question. Through the co-chair, Representative Elam, Representative Hemshoot for the record, I couldn't agree with you more. I'll just say that right now we do have work underway to explore our formula. I think House Bill 261 is a really valuable partial solution to some of the gaps or problems or cracks that we're seeing in our foundation formula. Cracks in the foundation are never good, and we're finding them now. I think we need to let the task force play out. In the meantime, yes, it was a historic increase last year. I know districts are grateful for that increase. It was less than half of the need. And I think that's what we're seeing now is that need is surfacing. And until we have a chance to recalculate the formula, the BSA is the tool we have. And so I would encourage the committee to consider the constitutional obligation that we have and the tools we have for meeting that obligation. Our role as a legislature is to make sure that the districts have what they need. And I think we can fine-tune that through some revisions to the formula. In the meantime, what is the opportunity cost of doing nothing?
Rep. Schwanke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rep. Hemshoot, I'd have kind of two questions. When I think about this issue where we're at right now, my mind continually comes back to accountability. And there are two components of accountability when it comes to education. One is accountability to parents and the quality of education and what they have as expectations. Personally, I don't know any families that have moved out of state because they don't believe that the education quality is there. However, I do know dozens of families that have taken their kids out of brick and mortar schools because they don't feel that the districts are accountable to them as what kind of quality of education that they would like for their children. So I struggle with that. I guess my main question to you is, could you describe your view of accountability of districts in the financial sense, just like a business or a household when revenues decline? What should school districts be doing, and what is your view of responsible fiscal management?
Thank you for the question. Making some notes.
Rep. Hemshoot.
Yeah, thank you. Through the co-chair to Representative Schwanke, I would remind you that the homeschool families are still public school families, and the need there is not insignificant. And I would just offer that as we pare down what's available in the brick-and-mortar schools, if you take away music class in the brick-and-mortar school, because it's one of the first things that gets cut in really tight times, no district wants to do that, but if they have a music program and they cut it, what's the family going to do? There's no music in the public school. I can take this allotment and go get music for my child. So if they have the ability to homeschool, they might make that choice, and you get kind of a chicken or egg problem. Would they have preferred to stay in the public school? They might have. But if the opportunities their children are seeing are narrowed and they're able to meet those opportunities a different way, I could see why families might make that choice. The schools aren't able to offer what they used to. Art class is gone. Music class is gone. So those families would still be uplifted by an increase, but also if we can hold our schools together and continue to have the continuity of programming that we have right now without massive losses, more families might choose to stay in the brick-and-mortar schools. I think the accountability is built in with your local school board. I think the crisis that we've seen at Mount Edgecombe High School stems a lot from not having a local board. I think you as a school board member have probably experienced when families get upset about something and they come to the board. The board is a group of friends and neighbors that were elected to help those families and to make sure that the schools are staying on track. So I think that system has historically worked, and I wouldn't be interested in changing the system of our locally elected boards. So that's the accountability, in my mind, is through the local board. I know for myself as an educator, my door was open. Anytime a family had a question or a concern, and it's one of the most remarkable things we do to take the diversity of experiences and opinions in society and put kids and families together in one classroom and make it work. So people did come in with questions and concerns in my classroom, and I welcomed them. And we were able always to get to a resolution where the child continued to feel welcome in my room, no matter what difference of opinion I might have had with the family. So we could usually talk it out and get to a solution. So to me, the accountability rests also at that level with families to come and seek solutions if they're concerned. And then your other question was about fiscal responsibility. And again, that's, in my mind, the role of the local school board. When a school board says, we can't run our program, we're going to have this gap next year, I trust that local board.
I thank you for those questions and that response. And I do know that boards have to do an audit every year by statute. But I want to go to invited testimony now. I know Rep. Dibert is in the queue, but our invited testifiers might have to leave if I don't go to them right now. So thank you, Rep. Hemshoot and Ms. Lubin, for your testimony. And at this time, we'll switch to invited testimony. Our first invited testifier is Principal David Nogg of Anchorage. Mr. Nogg, am I saying that right? Your last name? I hope so. But please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you so much, as well as thank you to Co-Chair Story and the esteemed members of this committee. For the record, my name is David Nogg, and I serve as principal at Golden View Middle School in the Anchorage School District and president of the Alaska Council of School Administrators and the Alaska Association of Secondary School Principals. Thank you so much for sponsoring House Bill 374. I'm writing to urge the committee's support here today to increase the base student allocation for Alaska Public Schools. Every day we ask our educators to do more for children academically, socially, emotionally, that the resources available to meet those expectations have not kept pace with the real cost of educating our children in our great state. I want to say thank you. Thank you for the increase the legislature passed last year. It was an important injection into the base that was sorely needed to start to catch up and will help districts plan. Sustainable funding remains the most critical need for our public schools. And while the FY26 base student allocation is $6,650, the amount has an inflation-adjusted FY11 value of only $4,711. This funding gap is not theoretical. It affects staffing, class sizes, student safety, student support, and the school district's ability to plan responsibly and, most importantly, effectively. I call your attention to the ACSA Joint Position Statement handout highlighting our annual pencil charts that make it easier to see how far we have to go to catch up. We are so fortunate to have ALASBO, which is the School Business Officials Organization, as part of our Acts of Family. And every year they update the pencil chart using your legislative finance data. You can see where the increase from last year is reflected. You can also see how much is still needed. The impact of the rising fixed costs and healthcare costs and insurance transportation, energy, property insurance, liability insurance, operations, and maintenance continue to erode the purchasing power of schools. This makes it difficult to maintain high academic achievement and meet accountability requirements across the Alaska public school system. So, for example, the Alaska READS Act, which we all support for our children, has fallen pretty exclusively on school districts to implement and has become a huge unfunded mandate, adding even more pressure to budgets across the state. Recently, ACSA did a survey to all districts that provides a snapshot of the majority of school districts' expected budgets. The survey results, which represent responses from the majority of Alaska school districts, a summary of the statewide FY27 deficit snapshot based on survey responses to date looks as follows. 43 districts have responded thus far. 32 of those districts report a projected FY27 deficit. These total reported deficits range from about $142.4 million to $146.8 million, and this is based on districts that provided numerical estimates. The largest reported deficits in our respective districts are as follows. Anchorage, we are currently facing a $90 million deficit. Matsu, $22 million. And kind of as a side note to this, if the borough increases its allocation to offset the state reduction tied to increased property values, the projected deficit would be approximately $19 million. The North Slope, $9.9 million. And the Kenai, at $8.6 million. Some of the most commonly reported reductions in this survey is that of staff reductions and attrition. Increased class sizes, reduced activities, and the consequent travel associated with being well-rounded, the use of reserves as a short-term bridge. In the survey, the reported BSA needs for districts have a range that's cited from anywhere from $240 to $900 for students. Some rural districts reported need exceeding $2,000 per student. This clearly demonstrates the need for this important bill. As one of the longest serving principals in Anchorage, and in my time as principal, I have seen workloads increase while funding stays the same, and that causes extreme principal and teacher turnover. As a middle school principal, I've seen firsthand what thoughtful investment in education can accomplish, and what happens when that investment falls short. Last year, our district made a research-based best practice decision to transition to a true middle school model by moving the sixth grade into our middle schools and creating a 6-8 continuum for students across the Anchor School District. The research is clear. Students benefit academically and socially and emotionally in a comprehensive middle school environment designed specifically to prepare them for high school and life beyond school. To prepare for this transition, I hired 9 new teachers to serve the additional 320 students who joined our school community. Unfortunately, due to district budget shortfalls tied to inadequate funding of the base student allocation, I was forced to lay off 6 of those 9 teachers within a year. Many of those talented educators left the district or state entirely. This year, the situation is even more difficult. I will lose 8 additional teachers, as well as 1 of my 2 assistant principals, and we will no longer have a consistent school nurse in our building that's currently serving 130 students. At the same time, the district's right-sizing initiative, which includes closing 3 schools, means I will welcome approximately 60 more students this next year. Bear in mind, our school has grown. For comparison, we are larger as we speak than Chubiak High School, as well as Eagle River High School for context. These cuts force real consequences for students. We are moving from a 7-period day to a 6-period day. For many students, particularly those receiving special education services, This means losing access to electives that help them discover passions and develop real-world skills. Students will no longer be able to take foreign language or family consumer sciences or a school business partnership class where they learn entrepreneurship, how to tend a ledger, how to create promotions, and even earn a barista certification. Or, equally, in some cases, far more importantly, cannot participate in band, orchestra, or choir. This is especially painful in a year when our music program has been invited to perform at Carnegie Hall, a historic first for our school. Another impact of this is that students will lose access to applied technology courses where they learn coding, robotics, AutoCAD, and 3D printing skills that prepare them for the 21st century workforce. They may also lose the opportunity to participate in our student-produced news program, GVTV. Check us out on YouTube. It's the only daily program of its kind in Alaska, and one that was previously recognized with a commendation from the Alaska State Legislature. At the same time, state expectations continue to increase. Physical education and health mandates require students to take those courses, and rightfully so. But as part of that, we can no longer grant waivers that once allowed students access to these electives. Another additional loss is the loss of collaboration time. And collaboration time, we refer to as CT time, is where team teachers, as well as paraprofessionals, meet to discuss and create plans for and with struggling students and their families and guardians, as well as Fed teachers, migrant education student success coaches, ELL teachers, counselors, our APD school resource officers, school psychologists, occupational, physical, and speech therapists, as well as our assistive technology specialists that help us serve students who are blind and visually impaired, as well as deaf and hard of hearing, in conjunction with case managers and building administrators to appropriately and objectively do everything we can to meet the needs of our students and families. Due to our current funding state, we are losing this vital and impactful support. And this isn't hyperbole, it's a devastating reality. Despite these challenges, our school remains committed to inclusive practices. We strive to ensure all students learn alongside their peers, even as classes currently sit in core subjects at 35 to 40 students. In our physical education classes, we have 50 to 55 students. In our band class, 75 students. What inspires me most is our students themselves. The second most requested elective this year is our Partners Club, where students provide peer support to classmates with significant cognitive disabilities. Our students are choosing compassion, inclusion, and community. I ask you to reflect on that. Our students are demonstrating what it means to support one another. Today I ask for that same thoughtful support from you. Despite these fiscal challenges, our school achieved an average of 150% student growth on the iReady diagnostic assessment across all three grade bands. Imagine what our students and schools across Alaska could accomplish with stable and appropriate funding. Appropriately funding the base student allocation is not just a budget decision, it's a commitment to Alaska's students. And as a born and bred Alaskan, I remember when I was a student at Clark Junior High, and it was during that time that I decided I'm going to become a teacher. And we learned about primary documents. And the primary document I want to reference is the State of Alaska Constitution, specifically Article 7, Section 1 of the Alaska Constitution. Public education. The legislature shall, by general law, establish and maintain a system of public schools open to all children of the state and may provide for other public educational institutions. Schools and institutions so established shall be free of sectarian control. No money shall be paid from public funds for the district benefit or of any religious or other private educational institution. As you all know, this education committee, that looks like a responsibility to provide timely, reliable, and predictable revenue for schools, funding the actual cost of education in all districts, and to provide full and equitable funding for initiatives, laws, and mandates that require additional resources. Our children deserve fully staffed, safe, inclusive, well-maintained schools, and I respectfully ask the committee to pass HB 374 to continue your commitment to ensuring every child receives free, appropriate, quality education that they deserve, what we all want for them. And in closing, I want to say, go Suns, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Principal Nogg, for your testimony. I am going to still hold questions and go to our next testifier since they are on a time crunch there. So our next invited testifier is Principal Elizabeth Kwame of Kenai. Ms. Kwame, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, through the chair. Good morning, Chair and members of the House Education Committee. My name is Elizabeth Kwame, and I am the proud principal of Sterling Elementary School in Sterling, Alaska. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today regarding House Bill 374. First, I would like to express my sincere gratitude for the increase to the BSA last year. It provided much-needed funding for schools and districts across our state. However, without additional funding, schools like mine are set to close this upcoming school year. Sterling Elementary serves approximately 110 students in grades K through 6. Our small size is a huge asset for our students. It's a place where our staff knows every single student and a place where the students know the names of all of their other fellow Sterling Falcons. Our tight-knit community feel is what makes our school a special place. I've worked in 5 different schools over the course of my nearly 20 years in public education, and Sterling Elementary is head and shoulders above the rest in terms of the individual attention that we are able to provide to each student, and that's due to our size. Last year, Sterling Elementary had some of the highest growth in reading in the entire Kenai Peninsula Borough School District. However, it's become harder to maintain that same level of education as we've continued to lose certified teaching positions due to budget shortfalls. In the last 2 years, our school has lost 3.5 certificated staff. This includes a school counselor, 2 classroom positions, and a teacher who provided critical reading interventions for our students who are most at risk. I now have 5.5 teachers for 7 grades, and the task of providing reading interventions has fallen to classroom teachers and paraprofessionals. It's really unlikely that we will be able to show the same level of growth this year as compared to last year due to our staffing. This school year, I have a half-time teacher in the kindergarten classroom, despite kindergartners being at school all day. I've worked with my staff to create a schedule where kindergartners are learning all day, despite their main teacher only being there till noon. As the school principal, I spend 1.5 hours each day teaching third grade language arts and another 30 minutes with the kindergartners, all on top of my administrative duties. Now, as Sterling Elementary is facing the real possibility of closing, my concerns are about the impact that this closure will have on 110 Sterling Falcons, as well as students at other schools around the state that are set for closure. I mentioned earlier that our size allows us to provide individualized attention to each student. I know from my experience working in larger schools that it will not continue to be a possibility to provide that same level of individualized attention when we consolidate into a larger school. If we close, Sterling students are set to consolidate into a school that is currently 2.5 times our size and will be 3.5 times our size when we consolidate in. This school also shares a building with another roughly 150 students. So we would be going from a building of 110 students to a building with over 500. Last week, I met with the current principal of Sultan Elementary, which is where my students will attend next year if we close. Through our calculations of student enrollment and the allocated staffing for next year, which is based on the current BSA, we determined that classrooms are set to have close to 30 students apiece in grades K through 6. Student learning and growth will be impacted for my students as well as the current students at Soldotna Elementary. Unfortunately, we won't be able to maintain the significant academic gains that have been made over the last few years, and I spend many nights worrying about some of our most vulnerable students and how this will impact their education. One student comes to mind, and I'd like to share a little bit of his story. This student struggles academically and behaviorally due to a learning disability. He came to Sterling Elementary last year after being enrolled at a larger school in our district. At the other school, he struggled, and his confidence and desire to learn took a nosedive. When he transferred to our school, everything changed for him. The smaller environment and close-knit community feel of Sterling Elementary transformed his learning experience. He's now happy to come to school, and his desire to learn has returned. He's made significant progress in his academics and in his behavior. The transition to a larger school for this student and for many others will be detrimental to their learning and their overall well-being. Without a meaningful increase to the BSA, communities in our state will lose their schools, and students will lose their support systems in which they thrive. I urge you to support HB 374. Our children are the future of this state, and they are worth the investment. Thank you so much for your time and for your service to our great state.
Thank you, Principal Kwame, for your testimony, your passion for your students, and I can say the same for Principal Nogg. We are very grateful for your work with our children and their families and your teaching staff. I recognize being a principal is foundational to school's progress, so congratulations on the progress that you noted today. I have Rep. Dibert and Rep. Eichheit in the queue. I recognize that our principals might have had to drop off, but I will be happy to get questions out to anyone who testified today or to Rep. Himshut about the bill before us. And we have about 5 minutes left. And so I'm going to go to Rep. Dibert and then Rep. Eichheit.
Thank you, through the co-chair. Not so much of a question. Maybe I'll come up with a question at the end, more of a comment. With the numbers that are regarding Fairbanks that you'd mentioned in your slideshow. In Fairbanks, we've had a very, I just wanted to share with the committee, we've had a very tough, rough couple of years, maybe 5 or 6 years, where we are in a little bit of a surplus now. But that took a lot of hard work from our school board. We've cut to the bone. We have closed 6 schools. One of those schools, a constituent brought up to me, was Eielson Air Force Base High School, which they proceeded to tell me that Eielson is it's the second economic generator for our community. And then, you know, for families to come up and serve at Eielson Air Force Base and not have a high school for their student, you know, that's a tough sell. You know, we need, so that's one of the schools that were hit. And I recently met a family who was up here. Their son got accepted to University of Alaska Fairbanks engineering program. They were very excited. They were, they loved Alaska, they loved Fairbanks, and they loved the campus. So they were asking me about the community and like they wanted to move up here and asking me about the schools. And so it was very tough, but I was honest and just said, you know, we've closed 6 schools recently. Our high school, the high school near UAF, has 40 students in classes, and that's just where we are. It's a challenge to fund school. So I'm very supportive of this bill, and to be able to tell folks who are interested in moving to Alaska, we want in migration, not out migration, to have to share these statistics. And Fairbanks has cut to the bone. I support this bill. I'm grateful for your work. And, you know, this bill will help with salaries so that we can recruit and retain teachers back into Fairbanks and keep the good ones that we have. Thank you, Co-Chair.
Thank you, Rep. Dybert. Rep. Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story. Through the Co-Chair to Co-Chair Hemshute, thank you for bringing this bill before us. Thank you for the excellent presentation. I just wanted to ask a question using your deep knowledge of Alaska education, and I honor that. So I'm going to go to the veteran with this question. You know, here's a couple things I know from sitting on this committee. I know last year when we were talking about school funding over the years, since approximately 2011, about 15 years ago, we know that inflation has drastically outpaced education funding in Alaska. And I know what inflation does to my bottom line. I was at the grocery store yesterday. So that's a real cut. We also know, Co-Chair Story, I think, made this real apparent, that last year's historic BSA increase was only $20 per student over the previous year's BSA plus one-time funding. So the numbers are important. And we also, on this committee, we talk a lot about accountability. So using your knowledge of Alaska schools and education, you know, when I talk about accountability, I'm thinking about student learning growth. I'm talking about student engagement. We had an excellent presentation on Girls Can Weld. That was engagement 110%. And also things like graduation rates. Is there any evidence that flat funding improves any of those three things? If we continue to flat fund education, can we expect any of those measures to improve student learning, student engagement, and graduation rates? I mean, essentially I'm asking, can we cut our way to success?
Through the chair.
Through the co-chair, I'm going to take that as a rhetorical question, but I have not found evidence or reports or studies that support the idea that flat funding will improve outcomes. I'm not even sure I can say for certain that there are studies showing that flat funding harms outcomes, but I think it's common sense.
Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. I am going to have everyone save. I don't see anyone with a question right now, but I thank you for your presentation, Rep. Hemshute, and your work on this. I am going to set House Bill 374 aside. Its next hearing will be this Wednesday, March 11th at 5 p.m., during which we will hear public testimony. We opted to put in a testimony at 5 just because we know families and staff and communities, it's easier to testify than 8 to 10 in the morning. And so that will be happening this Wednesday night. Those wishing to call in may do so from the following numbers: from Juneau, 907-586-9085. From Anchorage, 907-563-9085. From all other places, 844-586-9085. So that concludes our presentation for today. A few announcements. I just want to remind people at Wednesday at 8 a.m., we will be having our joint House Senate Education Committee to meet with our State Board of Education. They are in town this week, and so it's our time for our annual visit with them. I'm pleased that we will be doing that. If time allows that day, we will hear bills previously heard. As a reminder to the public, the committee's email address is house.education@akledge.gov. Public testimony can be sent to this address or any comments, and we will get, if you mail it to that address, we will get it to the committee members. Seeing no further business, and in the committee, it is now 9:52, and we are adjourned.